Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to a special episode of ModPath Chat. Our Meet the Expert guest today is Dr. Pedro Margani. Dr. Argani has made significant contributions to the field of renal neoplasia, which will be the topic of our conversation today. He has been a member of the WHO Working Group for the Classification of Renal Tumors since 2004. That's 18 years, so coming up on the third edition that you're involved with. Dr. Argani is highly dedicated to education of both medical students and pathology trainees. He has been awarded the Johns Hopkins Pathology House Staff Faculty Teaching Award 9 different times. Just for a reference, to put it in context, I spent 12 years at Hopkins. I managed to get it only one time. So they really love Pete's teaching, and it's really well-deserved. Pete serves on the editorial board of the American Journal of Surgical Pathology and the International Journal of Surgical Pathology and Advances in Anatomic Path. But most importantly, he's the senior associate editor of Modern Pathology, the most important of all journals. Thank you, Pete, for accepting my invitation today.
It's my pleasure, George. Great to see you.
So clearly the topic you can talk about all renal tumors, and your contributions has been immense in that field. But let's focus on the recent editorial that you and Rohit Mehra wrote in the March issue of the journal, accompanying 5 different manuscripts that touch on the topic. And it's an amazing collection. I refer our reader to pick up that journal and read all 5 great manuscripts. They all revolve around the findings of TSC alterations, somatic, so to speak, in some pink renal tumors. And this has been a difficult topic for a lot of us in practice. So I wanted to spend the time with you talking about these pink tumors in the setting of TSC and what the implications of that. So take it and run, my friend.
Okay. Well, I always like to, George, you and I have been around long enough that we kind of remember how these things evolved. And sometimes the stories make these more understandable and more memorable. So, I remember when I started around 99 or so, we all know that patients with tuberous sclerosis frequently develop cysts and angiomyolipomas. And then with, the discovery of epithelioid angiomyolipoma, which was, spearheaded by one of our mutual friends, Guido Martignoni, mm-hmm. There was a thought that maybe all of these renal epithelioid neoplasms in patients with tuberous sclerosis might be these epithelioid angiomyolipomas. But while a lot of them are, certainly there are renal cell carcinomas that arise in patients with tuberous sclerosis. About 4% of patients get them. And two very nice studies in this last decade came out describing and sort of categorizing renal cell carcinomas in patients with tuberous sclerosis. And they sort of break into three main categories, one of which is renal cell carcinomas with clear cells, papillary architecture, and prominent smooth muscle. The other is one with eosinophilic cytoplasm, a macrocystic type appearance, and then ones that look like the eosinophilic variant of chromophobe carcinoma, what we probably all used to call that. And since those tumors occur in patients with the syndrome, we might expect that we might get those same tumors in the somatic setting arising in patients who now have somatic mutations in the TSC genes or in the mTOR gene, which is, you know, we know is in the same pathway. And that now seems to be the case, and I think it's pretty well established. So we now know that eosinophilic solid and cystic renal cell carcinoma, which is described by Kirill Tripkov and Jesse McKinney, is the somatic version of the macrocystic eosinophilic variant. Big pink cell tumor, lots of cysts, basophilic cytoplasmic stip linked to the cytoplasm. We know that the renal tumors that have the clear cytoplasm and papillary architecture and smooth muscle, those are the renal cell carcinomas with fibroleiomyoma to stroma. Those are the somatic counterparts to that that have now been well described. And then corresponding to the tumors that have that eosinophilic chromophobe appearance, I think are two sporadic tumors that have been described, one of which is now called by the GUPS the eosinophilic vacuolated tumor, tumor with eosinophilic cells, prominent nucleoli, hyalinized stroma, dense calcifications, usually stains with CD117, but not CK7. And then there's the low-grade oncocytic tumor, or LOT, which is the tumor that looks very close to the eosinophilic chromophobe RCC, a little less of the Raisinoid appearance of the nuclei, but often has this, what's been described as the boats in a bay appearance, where you have a lot of edema and these small angulated nests of lesional cells. That tumor stains with CK7, but not CD117, unlike eosinophilic variant of chromophobe, which would typically label with both. So I think, and these papers that came out in Modern Pathology really solidify that there are, that these somatic counterparts have the same mutations in the same genes, and it makes a really nice story. I think it's gratifying in that it sort of puts all the pieces together. There are some issues, though, that we have to deal with, right? Because, for example, we can have tuberous sclerosis mutations as secondary events in clear cell RCC. These tumors that we're talking about appear to be driven by the TSC, and therefore we get downstream activation of things like cathepsin K, GPNMB. So that's one issue. And then other issues are, you know, are these things completely discrete? Is there some overlap among these? Should we group them into a family? So there is some debate, I think, among different pathologists about that.
Very elegantly put. So basically, to summarize for our audience, because not everyone is as savvy in renal tumors as you are. So RCC with fibromyomatous stroma, or RCC-FMS, ESC with and LOT and EVT. These four tumors now, we know that they can have somatic alterations in the TSC/mTOR pathway, which will come into second. What's the significance of that? Akin to what the inherited counterpart in TSC syndromes morphology. And this is not new. I mean, this keeps happening in renal tumors. We learned from the inherited syndrome, first started with the clear cell carcinoma in VHL patients, and then realized that not every RCC is within that context, and they can have somatic alteration where you lose one of the copy of the tumor suppressor gene. Now, so what in terms of significance, and you touch upon this because as we've discussed previous episode with Dr. Mark that it seems like the classification of renal tumors is moving toward hopefully one day where there'll be a lot of driver mutation-based or driver alteration-based classification, which will make it a little more consistent. But we're not there yet. But at least in those lesions, it seems like these alterations, not that they're a prerequisite for, correct me if I'm wrong, for the diagnosis, but may also emphasize, like you're saying, maybe you put them under one umbrella and call them the TSC-driven or TSC pathway renal cell carcinomas, similar to what we do with SDH or FH. Tumors. But there is significance even as a somatic, even if we keep them as. And I was very intrigued when you mentioned in the editorial how mTOR alteration lead to cells being bigger, which I always love how genetics and morphology coincide. And really, many of these tumors do have large cells, which is fascinating to me. But there is therapeutic implications for that, correct?
Yeah, and that's important, because while these are basically of these tumors of the eosinophilic types, only the ESC has been documented to metastasize. The EVT and the LOT have not. Though I would say that even though there is follow up on those cases, it's not long enough, because they're slow growing tumors, and you really, to my mind, need 15 or so year follow up, 20 to be sure that these are going to be benign, maybe even more. But yes, you can treat these patients with mTOR inhibitors, the rare ones that have metastases. And, you know, we had a very memorable case here that kind of led to this thinking. We had a patient who was a young patient who had a eosinophilic RCC that had metastasized to her liver. And this was, 10 years ago. And, it turned out to be an ESC, and she actually did receive mTOR inhibitors. And I, 10 years later, received a call from her medical oncologist saying, should we stop? Because the patient's tumor is actually completely shrunk. Wow. So these, and you think about it, metastatic renal cell to the liver, you're not expecting the patient to be around usually 10 years later. So there is implications there. The other implication is I've seen some cases, particularly in children, where they have bilateral tumors. And it reminds me almost of the situation with Wilms tumor, where when you have bilateral tumors or nephroblastomatosis, what you really want to be able to do is shrink the tumors beforehand and then do sort of nephron sparing surgery so you don't end up putting the patient on dialysis. We've seen at least one case where on a small biopsy, we're able to diagnose one of this family of tumor, an ESC, in fact, and they were able to give the patient an mTOR inhibitor and shrink all of the rest of their tumor so that the patient actually didn't need to have a significant surgery afterwards. So there's potential there in people who have bilateral disease to do nephron sparing surgery with preoperative mTOR inhibitor.
Excellent. So for our audience we all struggle with this, and the classification of renal, as I mentioned, I got Holger Mock's view on this, but I would love to see your practical approach. Is every day we're faced with tumors, and now we know everything can look like everything else. They're not so well categorized as they used to be based on morphology. And we find ourselves either ordering a lot of immunos or doing a lot of, molecular testing. How do you approach it on a day-to-day basis when you get a pink tumor? And if you can share and help, especially the younger audience, the best way practically to approach it.
Yeah. So, I just in general, I would say I do most of my renal tumors, my clear cells, just on the H&E. I think that's totally legitimate. And, papillary RCCs. But the pink cell tumors, I think, have a broader differential because they can overlap a lot. So, I mean, the way I go through it is my first thing is it even epithelial? Because I have a lot of respect for what epithelial angiomyolipoma can look like. Then I go and see if it meets criteria for oncocytoma, which is, you know, something that we can call benign with the round nuclei nested architecture, edematous stroma. And then, you know, I look at other things, clinical history, you know, is it patient on dialysis where I'm going to start thinking about acquired cystic disease, RCC. But then I think of when those things are eliminated, then I go into my differential of things that can look a lot alike. So I think about eosinophilic chromophobe. I think about these tuberous sclerosis associated tumors, the ESC, the HOT or the EVT and the LOT. The TFEB translocation tumors, I've been shocked having seen a lot of them. I've seen ones that look very much like oncocytoma on core biopsy, and I could easily have been fooled by. And then fumarate hydratase and SDH, succinate dehydrogenase deficient tumors, you know, while they have a classic morphology, there's ones that can look like oncocytoma in from both of those. So I would think about those stains. And then what I'm truly don't know, I have a lot of respect for ALK because ALK tumors can look like almost anything. And if I really don't know, I might throw on an ALK. I would say most of the time, though, like when I get a tumor, I go based on the morphology. If it really looks like a low-grade oncocytic tumor or an ESC, I might just do a few stains, you know, like a CK20, a CK7, a KIT, and a cathepsin. And that should be all. If the morphology fits and my immunos fit, I'm fine with that. I wouldn't go and do molecular. In contrast, if there is a patient who has either a disease that they can't resect or they happen to have they're a rare patient with metastatic disease, even if I am pretty sure of the diagnosis on morphology, I might actually push to do the molecular because I want to give them that therapeutic option of using an mTOR inhibitor. And I'm not sure all urologic oncologists are up on this or are thinking about this. So I try to put it in their head by actually seeing if we can get the stain, get the molecular ordered and give them a target.
Wonderful. Very, very helpful. So, which bring us to you also that was mentioned in the editorial and the closing remarks that right now the NCCN recommendations, if you're a young patient with a renal tumor, 46, I think is the cutoff they used. And I've been in my practice also recommending that because not everyone is as savvy. And I try to mention the possibility of inherited syndromes. And in the past, we started doing that with BHD and SDH, like you mentioned, bring the attention that this could be a familial syndrome. So now you guys mentioned in the editorial, these tumors that we just talked about today, the TSC spectrum, probably also should be added because while they were talking that they can be somatic, they also can be genetic. You want to say, so have you started mentioning that if they're bilateral or multifocal?
Yeah, I think if there's more than one, and particularly if you see angiomyolipomas in the background on a careful exam, I think often looking at the non-neoplastic kidney, you can find small angiomyolipomas that might be a clue. So I do mention it. I mean, I just put it in their heads that this could be syndrome related, and then they can decide if they want to pursue germline testing.
Wonderful. Well, this has been enjoyable and very informative. And I want to say you're the first guest that makes it twice to our podcast. And there is a reason behind that, because your original podcast is the most downloaded among all this is our 46th episode. So thank you for coming again. And I'm sure our audience will learn a lot from listening to this. And I congratulate you and on all the great things you've done to the field and will continue to do.
Thank you, George. It's great to see you. And thank you again for the invitation.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.